You're listening to Boston Public Radio. Today we're bringing you a collection of some of our favorite interviews from the not-too-distant past. We begin with Academy Award-winning filmmaker Errol Morris. We talked about his latest documentary, The Unknown Known. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Some few of you may know him as a congressman from Illinois. Others might know him as U.S. Ambassador to NATO, or how about as the director of Amylin Pharmaceuticals? But no doubt just about all of us know him for this.
As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
That, of course, is former Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld, the subject of Errol Morris's latest
Secretary of Defense.
Secretary of Defense. Thank you. Well, Errol Morris, it's a pleasure. And the documentary is The Unknown Known, and it is spectacular. Errol, thank you for the correction. You are Errol Morris. Is that correct? Did I get that right?
You got that much right.
No need to correct that.
Okay, fine.
So, Errol Morris, I said as you're walking into the studio that when I watched the documentary, I was horrified. And I guess I was horrified because this is a very serious subject, you know, war and Guantanamo and all these things. And Donald Rumsfeld struck me as almost like this was a big game with all his plays on words. He was almost cheerful. And I just, that was my takeaway at the end of it. I thought,
why almost?
Well, okay, totally cheerful. It was like it was a big, a joke is maybe too strong a word, but his hubris. And anyway, that was my takeaway. What was yours? What do you think of this man? You spent hours and hours with him.
My takeaway?
Yes.
Having made this movie, maybe I don't have to think about it anymore.
Okay.
Well, you're not. Your style of interviewing, for lack of a better expression, I think interviewing is fair. You obviously choose to let people talk, not to be confrontational. Occasionally, we'll get to a second, you did challenge Rumsfeld on a couple of things. How do you decide, how do you make that decision when you have strong feelings that essentially let Rumsfeld speak for himself, let him explain his life? And I assume the end of that sentence is, and let the viewer, let the filmgoer judge him or herself. That's a fair description of your style, is it not?
It is. A friend of mine once said that you can never trust someone, maybe you can't trust anybody, but you can never trust someone who doesn't talk a lot, because how else would you know what they're thinking? There is this underlying idea. You allow someone to talk in an attempt to uncover what they're thinking, who they are. And that is at the heart of the enterprise, for better or for worse.
But you really, I want to stay on this for a second.
We are arguing with each other.
We are indeed.
I want to get
you
back
resisted,
to what I
with
to
a
ask.
Couple of exceptions I can think of, you resisted what had to be an internal urge to challenge. Let's just play one clip. Here you are. You just pointed out to Rumsfeld there was a lot of confusion amongst the American people about whether Saddam Hussein was actually involved in the 9/11 attacks and al-Qaeda. And here is Rumsfeld's reaction to what you had to say, Errol.
Oh, I don't think so. It was very clear that the direct planning for 9/11 was done by Osama bin Laden's people, al-Qaeda, and in Afghanistan. I don't think the American people were confused about that.
In 2003, in a Washington Post poll, 69% said they believe it is likely the Iraqi leader was personally involved in the attacks carried out by al-Qaeda.
I don't remember anyone in the Bush administration saying anything like that, nor do I recall anyone believing that.
Mr. Secretary, today in a broadcast interview, Saddam Hussein said, "There is only one truth. Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction whatsoever." And he went on to say, "I would like to tell you directly, we have no relationship with al-Qaeda."
And Abraham Lincoln was short.
Would you care to respond directly to what Saddam Hussein has said today?
How does one respond to that? It's just a continuous pattern. This is a case of the local liar coming up again and people repeating what he said and forgetting to say that he never, almost never, rarely tells the truth.
Well, what stayed with me, Errol Morris, is he didn't miss a beat with you, even though you directly contradicted his assertion. He didn't miss a beat with the press. Well, what did that say to you about the man? The facts never stood in the way of his assertion that he was right.
Well, first, you have to explain to me, how is that not challenging him?
No, I said those are two examples. You also challenge him on the whole, we don't assassinate foreign leaders, and you mentioned Dora Farm. Those are the two exceptions. I wasn't criticizing you for this.
There are many throughout the movie. What amazes me in many of the commentaries that I've read about this movie, alas, I do read my own reviews. I should know better, but I don't. People say that he wasn't challenged. He's challenged repeatedly. There are dozens of instances throughout this movie. What's so interesting is he doesn't see them as a challenge. He ignores them. He rattles on as if nothing really has been said. As if, maybe not as if, let me take the as if away. We'll lift the magic slate and erase it. He's oblivious to criticism, to contradiction. He lives in his own Rumsfeld bubble, impervious to criticism, isolated from everything.
But you're not oblivious to criticism. That's pretty obvious. Is that correct, well, Errol Morris?
I soak it up.
Well, I think, Errol Morris, that what you did, and it's a classic technique, and I think it worked brilliantly in this case, was to give this man enough rope to hang himself. And he, in my estimation, you didn't want to tell me what you thought about him because you said you'd done the movie, so you don't have to answer that question. But I think it's pretty clear what you think about him. And I want to play another clip. This absolutely drove me insane, is his whole play on words. He's talking in this case about absence and the absence of evidence. It's an example of how he shaped our foreign policy. Let's hear that absence of evidence clip, please.
Subject to discuss with P, meaning the President of the United States. The absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. When you say the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, what you're saying is that there is an absence of evidence about something. But you ought not to say that, therefore, that is proof that something doesn't exist. It's an easy thing to go from the first part of that in the wrong direction and say, well, the absence of evidence means it isn't there.
Now, I listened to Donald Rumsfeld saying things like this and similar things like this. And Errol Morris, it seemed like we were doing a crossword puzzle or something. It was all like it was a word game to show who was the cleverest at coming up with these phrases. And you've interviewed a lot of people. This is sort of unusual, isn't it?
The level of nonsense, the level of gobbledygook, this is quite extraordinary.
Yes, I thought so,
too. And what is really extraordinary is that we, and I include myself to a certain extent, bought into it. How many people have I heard say, oh, the unknown, the known, known, blah, 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 blah. This is really deeply profound. Absence of evidence is an evidence of absence. What is Donald Rumsfeld really telling us? He's telling us that evidence doesn't really count for much. So why don't we just make things up as we go along?
So, but is the fault solely with him, Errol Morris, or is it with the American people? When I was watching, I watched it again last night, your film, and it brought back stark memories of what a rock star he was when he'd have those press conferences, I think in 2003, where he answered virtually nothing. The press was fawning over him. Wasn't he voted sexiest man of the year in People magazine or some such thing? It's pogo-esque, is it not? Isn't part of the fault with us for buying into this drivel?
Well, there's a simple answer to that. Yes.
We're talking to Errol Morris, a man of few words here. Errol Morris's latest documentary, which, by the way, is spectacular, is called The Unknown Known.
Let's contrast this to a other former Secretary of Defense, who was the star in the fog of war, your 2003 portrait, Robert McNamara. We have a little sound of the former Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, for about one of the mistakes he believed the United States made in Vietnam. Here it is.
What makes us omniscient? Have we a record of omniscience? We are the strongest nation in the world today. I do not believe we should ever apply that economic, political, or military power unilaterally. If we had followed that rule in Vietnam, we wouldn't have been there. None of our allies supported us. Not Japan, not Germany, not Britain or France. If we can't persuade nations with comparable values of the merit of our cause, we'd better re-examine our reasoning.
So, Errol Morris, how are these two men different?
One thing's pretty clear. Donald Rumsfeld never really listened to Robert McNamara. I have no idea whether he saw the fog of war. My guess is he did not, but he did tell me in my first meeting with Donald Rumsfeld is he hated it. And he went on to explain, talking about Robert S. McNamara, that man had absolutely nothing to apologize for. I differ from him in that respect.
You know, Errol Morris, I've known you now for about, I think, 12 minutes. Is it fair to say that you're a fairly intense character? Is that a fair statement, characterization of you? It is it not?
I don't know.
Well, it is. Trust me on that. How do you shift, Errol Morris, from doing things like Fog of War, The Unknown Known, and then we all know that you directed commercials with 25 men by the name of Ronald McDonald praising Taco Bell's product. I'm serious. How do you compartmentalize things in a way that you can do those, which are brilliant, by the way, and I love them. I don't know what the public reaction was to them. And then you do these brilliant, in the case of Fog of War, Academy Award winning, this terrific new thing, relatively new thing about with Rumsfeld. How do you do those two different kinds of, how do you live in those two worlds?
In part out of necessity. Like most people, I do have to earn a living. And commercials have been a viable way for me to continue to work as a filmmaker, to do many of the things that interest me, and at the same time, provide for myself and my family.
Would you do them if you didn't, if it wasn't about the money? Because I think they're wildly entertaining. I think entertainment is a pretty valuable contribution to life. Would you not do them if it wasn't about the money? Would you just do documentaries?
Well, I've done over 1,000 commercials. Mm. So they're habit forming. Could I just give it up at this point? Probably not, because I enjoy doing it.
Can I play you one more? I'm sorry. We're talking to Errol Morris.
We're talking to Errol Morris, and in his latest film is The Unknown Known. You know, you had extraordinary access, obviously, to Donald Rumsfeld. How many hours did you actually shoot? How many hours did your conversations go on for?
Over 30 hours.
Okay, over 30 hours. That is extraordinary access to Donald Rumsfeld. And I kept thinking, and obviously you were thinking, because you ended your film by asking them this, why he ever agreed to talk to you. Let's hear this this clip from the film, one of the more memorable moments in it.
One last question. Why are you doing this? Why are you talking to me?
That is a vicious question. I'll be darned if I know.
And then the curtain comes down.
So would you care to tell us why you think he did talk to you?
The answer is a curious answer. It's his answer, really, to everything. Why did we invade Iraq? I'll be darned if I know. Why did we abrogate the Geneva Conventions? I'll be darned if I know. Why am I talking to you here in the studio today? I'll be darned if I know.
This is you now, not Donald Rumsfeld, correct?
Or this no? is me, more or less.
Okay.
I'm trying for concision here. But you did ask me, why do I think Donald Rumsfeld talked to me? Because we're talking about a man so oblivious to everything, so utterly self-confident, that what was there to lose? It was just another, as far as he was concerned, another press conference, another opportunity to rattle on. Vanity. My guess, and I can't answer for anyone other than myself, you really understand why he's making the movie through watching it.
Have you heard from him?
Well, I've...
Post the movie, I mean.
We continued to correspond briefly after the completion of the movie. Donald Rumsfeld is known for these endless snowflakes, these memos that were distributed by the thousands when he was Secretary of Defense. I also was the recipient of a whole number of snowflakes. I told him that I would show him rough cuts of the movie as we went along. I invited criticism. Please tell me what you like and what you don't like. Even though it was absolutely clear contractually that he had no control over the final editing of the movie. The decision of what to include or exclude was solely mine.
Did he ever take you up on your offer?
Oh, I have all of these. Someday they should all be published. Donald Rumsfeld's criticisms, my replies, his replies to my replies, etc.
So do you think he had the insight after seeing the film to draw away how, in some places, ridiculous he looked?
I could answer that one. The answer is a big fat no, is it not, Errol Morris? I think he's probably proud of himself, don't you think?
A very, very, very big, very fat no.
We were speaking with Academy Award-winning filmmaker Errol Morris about his latest documentary, The Unknown Known. Up next, you know him as a man of few words, but when he got behind the microphone, he couldn't stop talking, waxing philosophic on everything from William Shakespeare to Howdy Doody. Our conversation with Teller of the Penn and Teller Illusionist Duo is next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're replaying some of our favorite conversations. We'll pick things up with Teller of the illusionist duo Penn and Teller. Earlier this year, he brought his magic to Cambridge by way of his production of The Tempest at the American Repertory Theater. Teller, along with Aaron Posner, adapted Shakespeare's play into a shipwrecked magic show with music by Tom Waits and Kate Brennan. Marjorie kicked off the conversation, asking Teller to describe how the inspiration for this production came to him in a dream.
My obsession with the strange way that Prospero fights his battles in this play began with a dream. In the 1970s, I bought one of those books about how to remember your dreams and kept a little notepad by my bedside. And one morning I woke up and the dream I recorded was that I was Prospero on my island fighting mine enemies by means of shows. That is, I would, instead of trying to act upon you and force you to sit down, I would make you imagine that the ceiling was coming down at your head, and that would force you to that psychologically would force you to sit down. And when I looked back at the play, that really is the way he functions. He doesn't do anything to anybody. He makes a fake shipwreck that doesn't even get people wet, but scares the hell out of them. And And he, throughout the play, he doesn't behave like a typical Shakespearean revenge story. He, you know, a typical Shakespearean revenger would have, you know, knives and kill people.
Correct.
Or gouge their eyes out. But instead, what Prospero does is makes these haunting, scary, sometimes, you know, psychologically assaulting shows for them. And we thought that it might be interesting in this play to let the audience experience this level of amazement and distress that the other characters are experiencing by doing that to them with magic tricks.
How true to Shakespeare is this? I know you're a Shakespeareophile. You've done Macbeth, and what was it? Did you do Midsummer Night's Dream as
I
well?
I did Midsummer Night. That's the first show I ever worked on Aaron with. He was directing Midsummer Night's Dream in Philadelphia and invited me to help him with the magic there. And then he and I did a Macbeth a few years ago that was similar in nature of trying to share the inner life of the characters, the hallucinations of the characters with the audience.
So how true to Shakespeare is Tempest?
It's very true. I think this is the production that Shakespeare would have done if he had had the resources of the ART.
Was he into magic? Was Shakespeare into magic?
Well, there certainly is evidence in such surviving stage directions as we have from The Tempest, where he says, and by a quaint device, the feast vanishes, or the banquet vanishes. Quaint device, I think, is Shakespearean lingo for magic trick. Mm.
Tell people, you know, we assume that the WGBH, Boston Public Radio listener, knows the story of The Tempest from beginning to end, but maybe there are a few who don't. What is the basic story of The Tempest?
Prospero and Miranda, father and daughter, are the duke and princess-to-be in Milan, which in Shakespeare's time is Milan. And Prospero becomes obsessed with magic, and because he descends so deeply into this fascination with magic, he says to his brother, "Why don't you just take care of running the state?" Well, this awakens an evil nature in his brother, and his brother takes over, plunks Prospero and Miranda into a rowboat that is described as so rotten that even the rats have instinctively quit it, and drops them in the middle of the ocean, assuming they're going to die of exposure. But they don't. They find their way to an island, and they live there for 12 years, during which time Prospero hones his magic powers with the magical forces on the island, so that he keeps the island in control. It's full of these strange things like Ariel and air spirit. And they find Caliban, the son of a witch, monster, on the island. And Prospero's keeping control of that when, at the beginning of this play, his brother and some other people who done him wrong many years ago come sailing by on a boat, and Prospero decides to take revenge. And the story of this is how Prospero moves from merely being revengeful to realizing that revenge is really not the way to go about life.
And part of this production, two of the words that are overused in the English language, at least in my estimation, are hero and genius. Having said that, Tom Waits is a genius.
Yes.
He is just how'd you hook into him? He's an old buddy of yours or something?
I met Tom in the 1980s when he was doing Frank's Wild Years at Steppenwolf in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Some people who knew me and knew him thought that I would be helpful in creating some hallucinations for a drunk in a bar, which is, of course, a character that Tom is quite adept at playing. And I went out and I taught Tom a few basic sleight-of-hand tricks, and he immediately performed them better than almost any magician I've ever seen because he invested them with so much humor. He's such an actor. And when this production began to happen, somehow or other, Aaron and I were talking about the style of music, and we got in touch with Tom and Kathleen, and Tom said, "Hey, I don't like Shakespeare very much." And Kathleen said, "I love Shakespeare." And we got together, and we had a book that has sort of been the touchstone of the production, which is the story of Willard the Wizard, a magician who toured the Dust Bowl during the Depression. Mm-hmm. And we paged through and showed Tom pictures of this. And there's one page that shows Willard the Wizard's band on stage. And they're all these, it's like five rail-thin Depression-era people, you know, in suits, formally facing the audience with hats on. And a woman singing at the audience in this tent through an acoustic megaphone, that sort of thing. And Tom looked down and said, "Those are my people."
That's a good
great
Tom Waits imitation.
That's because I'm a little congested.
We're talking with Teller, half of Penn and Teller. You've all heard of their legendary illusionist duo that everybody knows about. You know, lot of people would love to have a career like your career. How'd you start? How'd you start getting into this whole magic illusion kind of stuff?
When I was 5 years old, I got sick. There are really two ways you get into magic. You get really, really sick, or you commit a crime and get imprisoned. And both of those things give you time to practice with nobody else around. When I was five, I got a really bad heart ailment. And while I was recovering, we had just bought a TV, and I was watching the Howdy Doody show.
Oh my
On it,
gosh.
There was a magical clown named Clarabelle.
I can't believe he's bringing Clarabelle up, because go ahead.
Tell me.
The most haunting experience of my young life.
Yeah.
Clarabelle was a character. You might be able to relate to this. Clarabelle did not do what? Speak on the show. Howdy Doody is Buffalo Bob and all that.
Yep.
And on the final, did you see the final episode, Teller?
I don't think so.
The final episode
is
30 seconds from being over. I'm a little boy. You were a little boy.
Mm-hmm.
Clarabelle looks into the camera and says, "Goodbye, kids." And I want you to know, and this is not it's not hyperbolic, I was haunted for years by the notion that Clarabelle, who I guess intellectually I knew, spoke, as most of us had a feeling you did, I was haunted by it for years. So I didn't mean to interrupt your story about Howdy Doody, but that's the impact it had
on me. A psychological insight into Jim here that we all enjoyed.
And you know when I thought about it the most? When I was in prison, actually, for a couple of years. And but I'm sorry. Go ahead with your story.
Clarabelle did magic tricks, and at one point they advertised that if you sent, I think it was 3 Mars bars, wrappers, and 50 cents, they would send you a Howdy Doody magic set.
Oh, my
gosh. And my parents, of course, I'm not addressing envelopes at the age of 5, but my parents sent away for it. And it came, and it was a flat envelope full of flat pieces of cardboard. And you took them out, and you cut out along the dotted lines, and then you tabbed these little things together. And they made little magic boxes.
Oh, my God.
There's a little magic box, and you open it, and you look inside, and there's 3 Mars bars in there. And then you sort of shake it up, and now there's 6, and then it can go back to 3. It was a really clever trick. And I'm sure my father must have sat down and helped me tab all of these things together. And I would sit... my parents had a storage room on the top floor of their Philadelphia row house that had very dirty windows. And in the afternoon, the sun would stream through those windows and the windows would light up. And I would sit there and just obsessively play with this magic set. And for some reason, that opened a chasm. You know, that it was a bit of psychological bedrock that I hit on really early. And I pursued that... in backyard magic shows, and then that led me to be interested in theater. So I got into local theater groups, and when I was in high school, I went to the same high school.
Yes, Teller and I went to Central High School, we did.
And I had a marvelous high school drama coach named David Rosenbaum, who loved Shakespeare, loved the classics. We did Oedipus Rex in high school, and people were crying. It was really something. He had Oedipus addressing the whole school from the same podium that the principal addressed the school,
knew
what his role was. I mean, he was a clever theatrical guy and really opened my eyes to how theater can work. So then I went off and went to college, studied Latin and Greek, became a Latin teacher, and in 1975, Penn called me up and said, I had become acquainted with Penn and a third partner named Weir, called me up and said, how'd you like to do magic this summer? I said, sure. He said, it goes through October. I said, oh, that's when school starts. And he said, yes, that's what we had in mind. So I took a year's leave of absence, and that turned into a permanent leave of absence.
But, before you move away from your childhood, I just wonder, you did a lot of magic tricks, I would assume, for your classmates and things at parties and things like that, did you?
I did magic tricks for, I believe, at the very bottom of the inferno. I forget which ring of that is. I did magic tricks for Cub Scouts. That's how horrible my life was. And I remember one of the most painful experiences of my career, which I date from starting at that point, was being there and making the enormous mistake of producing hard candy, which I tossed out to the children, to the Cub Scouts, who immediately began firing it back at me.
Oh, no.
And I was in tears.
I thought it would have made you heroic among your friends to be able to do these magic tricks.
Cub Scouts, brutal. Brutal.
Oh, that's terrible.
The worst, most cruel possible audience.
So tell her, since horrible. I'm sure you want some more Clarabelle trivia to take with you to your next. You want another one?
Sure.
Sure, why not? There were 3 people who played Clarabelle.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know who the first and most famous was?
Was it the same guy who played Captain Kangaroo?
Yes, it was. Bob Keeshan. That's right. Yeah. And isn't, now I'm thinking, isn't Clarabelle somebody's daughter? I haven't seen The Tempest in years. I'm going to come, Marjorie and I are both going to come see your production. Isn't Clarabelle somebody's daughter in The Tempest, if I'm right? The king or somebody?
Yes. Clarabelle, I think, is the name of the... I think that that's the name of the daughter who's now Queen of Tunis that they're on the way to or from her wedding.
Okay.
But it's so Clarabelle was already, you know, gender questionable.
Can we Shakespeare get back to the maybe saw Captain Kangaroo as a youth himself. I don't know.
Hey, as somebody who has been performing for ages, as you said, what's more anxiety provoking for you? Being on stage or with Aaron Posner putting something together and other people doing it for you, and you just have to stand there after your work is done and hope that it's as good as you know it to be?
Well, I don't stand there. What I do is I stand there with a little notepad, and then the next day I go in for 4 hours in the afternoon and I say, let's fix this now, shall we? Neither of them is anxiety-producing, really. They all make the little hairs stand up on the back of my neck, but if I didn't love that, I should get into bookkeeping.
No. Our goal, until you mentioned Clarabelle, was to go the furthest into an interview with you in your whole life where we didn't mention silence, but we blew it when you mentioned Clarabelle. What's the dumbest question you've been asked, teller, when you actually speak about you not speaking for the most part in Penn and Teller?
It's mostly people make jokes. You know,
a bad one? Because I'm probably going to make one.
Yeah, we want to avoid it, actually.
Just by raising it, you've already done it.
Oh, too late. Too late. We plotted this out perfectly.
I mean, I know that there is a certain novelty. It's as if a pig walked up to the microphone and started to speak. So I get all kinds of credit for intelligence that I don't really have.
Yeah, but you have talked in many occasions. One of them was the NPR thing about Houdini. Yeah.
Was there an NPR thing about Houdini?
Yes, there was. It was an NPR thing, too, at least according to our vast research that we did this morning. So they maybe stole the thing and they played it on NPR. But in any case, you talked a lot about Houdini.
Yeah.
And give us your 2 cents on Houdini in the realm of magicians.
Well, Houdini's the only magician who has ever mattered. Because he did more than just amuse. He stepped outside the frame and spoke to some very deep things that people were feeling at the time. He was an immigrant, and the United States was full of immigrants and all people who were fleeing oppressive governments. And his whole the centerpiece of his act was what he called self-liberation. So already there is a subtext that speaks to everybody. Houdini was also in an age where people had just started to work in factories and in cities. Houdini was a fitness nut, and so he became an icon of fitness as well. So you know, when you see all of those pictures in which Houdini's on the front page of newspapers wearing basically nothing but some discreetly placed chains, that's also speaking to something that's very deep in what people were looking for at the time. And then in his latter days, the religion of spiritualism was very popular, and it was being promoted by a lot of creeps who were using magic trick technology to persuade people that they were talking with their dearly beloved dead. And this outraged Houdini, who was very close to his mother. And when his mother died, he tried contacting spiritualists to see whether they could indeed speak to his mother. Indeed, people as famous as Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's wife believed that they could communicate with the dead. And when Houdini was found that these people produced disappointing answers or absolutely simply conjuring tricks masquerading as religious contact with the realm beyond, this outraged him. And so there's a whole part of his career that was a moral campaign to prevent people from being sucked in by these frauds. So he hit the world, apart from the fact that he was an astoundingly intense performer. You know, he would come to he had a voice with the power of an opera singer, right? Hugely powerful voice. And when he would step to the footlights with these steely blue eyes, people described it as he looked like a panther about to spring into their midst. So combine an intense personal presence with these things that rode on what people were feeling about already, combined with this very important moral point that it's tremendously important to consult magicians if you want not to be fooled by frauds. And you have the ingredients for the only magician who ever really dug himself so deeply into the world's psyche. You know, other magicians are mild entertainers.
That was wonderful. I'm so glad I asked you about Houdini.
That's the voice of Teller, who there in Posner has adapted Shakespeare's The Tempest. That is at the Great ART. Is there an illusion that you've been dying to master for much of your career that you haven't quite gotten down yet, Teller?
Well, there's something that's I had really always wanted to do a spectacular levitation. Well, which is in the show, mm-hmm. you know, which is in the
I see a picture of it. I think isn't it this here?
That is a picture.
Could
of
you
it.
Show that to our radio audience?
Please, go ahead, by the way.
Well, it is a woman. It is a woman in a beautiful gown. Being she looks like she's about 3 or 4 feet off the floor.
It's. You recall Willard the Wizard, the person whose image sort of inspired the feel of the show. One of the wonderful things that Willard the Wizard used to do in his tent was levitate his daughter at practically the footlights of the stage. Now, in a tent, there's no fly loft above to attach wires to, so this was quite a miracle. And it's a thing that I'd always wanted to touch on. And in The Tempest, there is a moment. The Tempest is mostly very contemporary. But there are a couple of sections of it that just don't hold for present-day audiences. And one of those is what's called The Mask, where Prospero has now betrothed his lovely daughter Miranda to the Prince of Naples, Ferdinand, and he wants to show off as a magician. And in Shakespeare's original, what he does is he calls in spirits who recite couplets about fertility and generation. And these couplets go on quite a long while, and they're not among the best moments of the text. And he calls it doing some vanity of his art. So we thought that for Prospero to do one spectacular magic trick that also was deeply romantic and was about betrothing his daughter to Ferdinand would be appropriate. And we looked at the Willard stuff and we said, let's do that levitation. But in the midst of that levitation, let's have Prospero present his beautiful daughter's hand to Ferdinand as he sits by watching in wonder. And we found the perfect Tom Waits song to put with this, which is Shiny Things, which is this heartbreakingly beautiful song from the point of view of someone who is saying that crows put in their nests things that glitter. And this guy wants to be to his beloved that shiny thing. So it's really quite something.
Oh, my God. We can't wait. Do you have an ART experience before? Do you have a connection before this, or is this a
no,
first?
No, I was at the Boston production of Sleep No More, mm-hmm. that sort of environmental version of Macbeth. And that's where I first encountered the ART people personally. And that was 5 years ago? And there's a long and windy path led us to this.
Now, before you go, Teller, if you can give me a little bit of advice, I have two goals in life that I have not achieved. One, I would like to be a clue in a crossword puzzle. Marjorie was a clue
in the
Wall Street Journal crossword puzzle. That you can't help me with. My other dream was to be inducted into the Central High School Hall of Fame for alumni. Now, not only are you in the alumni, mm-hmm. but when I broached it with you, when you walked into the studio, what was really depressing to me is you didn't even know that you had been inducted into the alumni. So do you have any advice for a lesser graduate of Central High School, the only boys public high school in the United States, which the Supreme Court of the United States said separate but equal was okay in terms of gender? Any advice from you?
In the old days. I would say contribute a lot of money. I think that would put you right into the Hall of Fame. I would say one of my proudest moments was that I've been a clue in the jumble puzzle twice.
You have not.
Oh, my God.
Yes, I have. And that was my father's favorite puzzle. So it was very, very gratifying.
Boy, that is pretty great.
That is pretty. You mean the word jumble things and you were in there?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I love the jumbles.
I was the picture. Penn and I were the picture in one and I was the picture. Excuse me, I was the picture in the other.
Now I have three things on my list.
Yeah, I think that goes above it all. At the jumble puzzle, forget the Hall of Fame, forget the other regular puzzle. The jumble puzzle, that is it. We were speaking with Teller of the famed illusionist duo Penn and Teller. He was in town earlier this year overseeing his production of The Tempest, which was on stage at the ART. Teller, along with Aaron Posner, adapted Shakespeare to incorporate magic. Coming up, we talk to another illusionist of sorts, a man who makes the near impossible seem utterly effortless. That's Philippe Petit, the higher wire artist who walked between the World Trade Towers. That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Today we're bringing you a collection of some of our favorite conversations from over the year. In May, while on his book tour, the high wire artist Philippe Petit dropped by to talk about the creative process and the thin line between being a criminal and a creative spirit. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is a man who probably shouldn't even be alive. 40 years ago, you saw it. I remember it like it was yesterday, by the way. He walked on a high wire between the two World Trade Towers, not once, but multiple times. We're talking about the high wire artist Philippe Petit. His new book is entitled Creativity, the Perfect Crime. He is appearing, we'll give you more details in a couple of minutes, at an event tonight, 6 o'clock at the Great Brattle Theater in Cambridge, sponsored by the Great Harvard Bookstore. Philippe, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
Oh, we are thrilled. We are thrilled to meet you. And Philippe, before we get to your book, which is very clever and very creative, that's the title, Creativity, the Perfect Crime. I did rewatch Man on Wire last night for the second time because you were coming in here today. And you talked about, and you talk about this in your book as well, feeling that death was close when you were about to step out on the wire between the World Trade Towers. That had to be part of what enabled you to do this, the acceptance that you could be gone.
No, actually, it's a strange contradiction, and most people who do not follow me in my preparation might not actually believe me, but I do not take any risk when I grab the balancing pole. I like the noble and beautiful and inspiring act of carrying my life across, and I really reject the idea of gambling my life. So Man on Wire gave some of the backstage, you know, like the 6.5 years of dreaming and planning, but I try to leave nothing to chance so that when I do that first step on the wire, I know the last step will be successful.
Now, can I contradict you with your own words, Philippe, if I may?
You can try.
Oh, I can try. Well, here is from your own book. He says, the plan, obviously the plan to walk between the World Trade Centers, painstakingly improved through much trial and error, had empowered me all along, gave me the courage to keep fighting the impossible. But once inside the towers, you wrote, I discarded most of its components in favor of sheer improvisation triggered by intuition and, yes, by chance. Well, did I do a good job of contradicting you or no?
No, because actually I am a man of contradictions, and it's part of my plan to reject the plan when it needs to be rejected.
Mm-hmm. You know, Philippe, when I remember both seeing the news at the time, and Man on Wire is one of my two favorite documentaries. If you haven't seen this, it is one of the most beautiful and powerful pieces of work, and it's based on a book you wrote, as we all know. Do you remember the feeling today, 40 years, August is the 40th anniversary, is it not?
Yes.
Do you remember the feeling in your body, what you thought and what you felt as you made your first step out on the water?
I do remember as if it were yesterday.
And what was, can you describe it?
Well, no, that's why I wrote To Reach the Clouds, the book on which Man on Wire, the documentary, was based. But no, I cannot do justice to that moment in a one-liner, but I can even try with one word. I would say elation, happiness, obviously, impatience was inhabiting me at the moment, at the time of that first step.
And tell people how thick the wire is.
It's if you look at the finger of your hand, most people's thumb will be more or less the size
okay.
of my cable.
And what kind of shoes when you
well,
do?
Well, I love to walk barefoot on the wire so I can feel very much my skin on the surface of the steel. Mm-hmm. But to be elegant on the wire. I cannot talk about other wire walkers from the circus. I'm not born in a circus, but I glide my feet. Therefore, I need a little slipper, usually with a buffalo skin sole, so I can do some gliding, which is obviously very dangerous, but not for me.
Let me just say, it's the voice of Philippe Petit. His new book is called Creativity, the Perfect Crime. We'll talk about that in just a couple of minutes. I'm sorry, Marjorie.
Well, I just wondered, too, because it's my chance to talk to you. So all these things I've wondered about for all these years. How hard is the kneeling and the lying down? I mean, to me, getting back up after kneeling or lying down as you do on the wire, I just can't even begin to comprehend how you do that.
Well, to me, again, as an artist who discovered, who learned by himself the wire, it should not be difficult. Certainly it should not look difficult, but it takes a lifetime to kneel or to lay down on the wire and make it look effortless.
Which
you
do.
And that's what my goal is in life, of course.
You know, what separates you, Philippe Petit, from all the rest of us? I'm serious. I know that sounds like an incredibly simple-minded question, but when I think, if people could see the joy on your face, and if you've read what Philippe has written, was your 10th book, I mean, the elation, to use the word you used a minute ago, comes through in your written words as best that it can, but there has to be something in you that doesn't exist most mere mortals that allows you to do this. What is that?
I'm mortal too, also.
Well, we hear
so
that,
I'm told,
yes, yeah.
I don't believe that, but anyway, no, I am not the only person who is burned by passion. I'm not the only person who would love to climb and look at the world from a different perspective. But it is true that sometimes our education, school, the powers that be, tend to repress our many senses and make followers out of us rather than leaders. So anyway, I led my life. I sculpted my life from a very early age, which is unusual. At 6 years old, I started learning magic by myself.
And that was the beginning.
Yes, that was the beginning.
Because, of course, he's not just, as people know who's read his books and seen Man on Wire, not just a man who walks on wire, but also a magician and a juggler and these other things.
I thought you were about to say walks on water, by the way, Marjorie.
No, I
would have
not
believed it,
but,
actually.
You know, you talk about something, Philippe Petit, which surprised me, because I guess this is an American view. I kind of see the French schools, and I'm apparently wrong, is much more liberal than the schools. You talk about the repressive schools and rigid parenting. You just alluded to it now, is teaching. And of course, we know that you were bounced out of some of those schools, but they were. Tell us about the schools when you were a kid.
Well, it will be an unpleasant memory because I was not interested at all. Why? Because I was developing by myself in a struggling way and trial and error way all my arts. You mentioned magic, juggling, and a high wire.
And drawing.
And drawing. And then later on, you know, I started doing theater and movies and lecture and building with carpentry. Anyway, I have many hats, as you would say in America. They call me here, I think it's a nice title, a Renaissance man.
Renaissance man,
yes.
Indeed.
So anyway, I do not really recall the asphyxiation that the school where, and you know, it was very ironic because the minute I was thrown out of 5 different schools and started my young life with my art, I would crave for knowledge. I would become a thief of knowledge, you know, stealing things here and there to enrich my own perception of the world. So how ironic, you know.
And
so what are you trying?
I just wonder what your parents thought about this constant bouncing out of these schools.
Well, the right way would be to
them?
Ask them. But I mean, I can tell you, I had hardly a dialogue with my parents for my entire life. Maybe at the end of my father's life, we become best friends. But during my life, I think, although they encouraged me in some ways, I think they never understood this vocation of a wandering troubadour and an artist.
And that is that's a perfect segue to your book, Creativity, the Perfect Crime. It seems that the theme is that while people do learn the rules that exist for whatever they're doing, if they're not willing to break the rules, almost become a lowercase c criminal, that they won't be able to experience the artistic spirit in all of its glory. Is that not where you're going?
It's not so much my point of view as it is my experience in life.
Mm-hmm.
And I, maybe because I was learning by myself everything, maybe because I was running away from the powers that be, but the feeling of rebellion was always associated with creating, and thus the subtitle of the book.
What do you want people to take away from this? If they read this, and by the way, it is great. It's not just your writing, and it's really engaging, and you're drawing. And what is it you want that the artist and all of us to take away from Creativity, The Perfect Crime, Philippe Petit?
I want nothing. I am not a person who scattered, messages and has goals.
But you wrote the book.
What I would like is people of all ages, all kind of life persuasion, will go through my book and will see in their own life a door being ajar, a window being open. And you see, I am not teaching in this book. I am pulling the reader in a wild galopade, in an adventure. So any reader, and they're all different, of course, will be able to use in that book many things, not so much to learn, sometimes to learn, but sometimes to remember that dormant within themselves is that passion, is that creativity, and let's unleash it.
You know, when I'm looking at you now, and I bet you a lot of people have this experience, for those who remember this moment from 40 years ago, it really was one of the starkest, most beautiful images I can ever recall. And this morning before you came, I was looking at a photograph of you on the wire. It is as beautiful a moment of humanity as one can. Do you appreciate
it? Well, that's what people said about it, too. Yeah. It changed their lives.
People say that, and that was a great compliment.
Do you have the ability to step outside of it yourself?
Yes and no. To me, what you were just saying now, I was saying, he's right. It's another continent. You see? Yes. And, of course, I was trespassing, pun intended, of course, because the birds, I was trespassing in the territory of the birds. And for a human, you're not allowed to do that. You don't have wings, So I was like an ugly bird trying to be. Become a wing creature for a few minutes.
You had obviously a special relationship with the World Trade Towers, having spent a lot of time studying them and sneaking up there and hiding under the tarps and everything else. It must have been unique from your perspective, the loss of them. The collapse of them.
Yes, it was unique and it was felt in a very personal way, but I believe I have no right to talk in the same sentence about the loss of two towers and the loss of thousands of lives that day,
Let me ask you something about your book. You have some really quirky stuff here toward the end. And I was saying to Jim some of these things before we came down today. You talk about things like why, for example, we crumple up paper before we put it in the wastebasket. Mm-hmm. And we do. And why people in ads for watches set the watch at 10:10 all the time. So now, do you have answers for our listeners to those?
Yes, of course.
The
engineer in me has answer about why the little tea bag that you leave from your cup start turning.
Yes.
It has to do with the torsion of the fibers of the dry cotton becoming wet and the heat. But anyway, no, all what I was doing by having those almost childish or probably childlike questions were to, again, remind the reader that you should ask yourself questions. Even when somebody asks a question, what time is it? Why do you want to know? You see? I mean, live your life in a surprising way. You, by surprising yourself, you'll surprise others. And that's only one of the many little facets of my creativity that I share in that book. But I'm very happy you picked up those questions.
Yeah, why do we do it? Why do we crumple up paper before we put it in the wastebasket?
Well, I should write a book about that.
We do. It's almost like instinctual. You feel like you have to do it. So, we talk a lot about raising children with creativity and how we stifle them with our education system here, too. I mean, what would you say to the parents, the moms and dads that are listening now that have a little six-year-old like you that was into, doing magic tricks and stuff, but maybe really hates school and is not paying attention to the teacher, the teacher's math?
Well, one of the best ways to support somebody that you love is to let them do what they want. So if I see a little kid who is engulfed into magic, I will not slap their wrist and burn their first deck of cards. I will encourage them. But it's very hard for parents sometimes to encourage their children, mostly if those children run in a direction that you do not approve of or for some reason that you don't want them to encompass.
What's next? I mean, one of the things I read this morning, I read a piece about you decades ago in The New Yorker in which you talked about, I hope I get this mostly right, that at least it was contemplated or suggested that you walk across the Grand Canyon. And it was miles and miles. And I think the word you used was it would be boring. to do that for walk hours. You would break the longevity record.
Were invited to put my Y in a giant canyon, I will choose a canyon that has a human's length. And also I will, you know, through the culture of my host, you know, I will present an opera in the Grand Canyon. That will be my artistic take. Because, again, since I was not born in the circus, I'm not interested in making my body travel from point A to point B and be applauded for that. I want much more. I want people to be amazed in a true, beautiful human way. I want them to be inspired. And fortunately, that's what my audience says to me when I land on the other side, not having done one crossing, but having written some kind of an opera in the sky.
So yeah. what opera in the sky, or what opera is on the horizon? What's the one that you've been planning for or thinking about
for
years?
Two secrets. Make sure you don't
tell
anyone.
We won't tell anybody.
Okay.
Yes.
The first one is this year is the 40th anniversary of my walk. So on August 7th, I have to be on a wire. Not, of course, between two towers, but maybe much lower so the audience could see my face, you know, and could appreciate the details of my choreography. So that's one thing.
In New York City somewhere.
Well, I think at the moment I am in the Hamptons. Oh, I said too much already. But August 7th in the Hamptons, you will hear about me. And then talking about giant Haiwa walk, I have very close to my heart a project that is just that. I need an angel, you know, to write the right checks. But it's a project in Easter Island. And I would love to put my rope from the belly of those sacred statues, the Moai, and have the Rapa Nui people, you know, with their dance and their costume and their music and their faith and celebration, be part of the walk. So an Easter Island walk is really something I have in my sleeve. But again, I am a poor artist. I need the rich angels to land on my project.
Can you, assuming your health is good and you're fine, can you...
You mean my mental health?
Well, your mental health but your physical health. Can you keep your balance stay with you if you live to be 90? Could you walk on a wire like at 85, or does your balance start to go?
I'm much more than that. At 96, I'll still be performing. You see, it's the art of walking that is the secret of a beautiful high wire walk. It's very easy to walk, and yet is the hardest thing in the world. Are they school of walking? Not really. So anyway, I will walk on the wire as long as my legs agree to carry me, and a little longer.
Okay. You know, this is a stupid thing. I should have known this, but I realized this reading this book, that the middle, of course, it's so obvious, the middle of where you have the wire set is the most treacherous.
Yes, yes,
why?
Yes. Well, why? Again, it's an engineering answer. It's a catenary curve. Catenary come from the chain in Latin, and it is when you hang a rope or a chain, in the middle, it's at its most sensitive in terms of the vibrations, you know.
Okay. Well, this is a wonderful book. The creative in us just revels in this book, and it's a pleasure to meet you. We were speaking with the Higher Wire artist Philippe Petit about his new book, Creativity, the Perfect Crime. Up next, a conversation with a man who you know as the sage of outer space, Spock. That's right, the very earthbound Leonard Nimoy was here, and he talks about his Boston roots. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. They say love is lovelier the second time around. Can the same be said for radio conversations? You be the judge. Today we're replaying some of our favorite interviews. Earlier this year, actor Leonard Nimoy was in town hosting a Boston Pops performance at Symphony Hall. He took time out of his day to join Marjorie and GBH's arts editor, Jared Bowen.
Leonard Nimoy, so great to see you. Thank you so much for coming
in. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you here. I just watched this documentary, which is so fantastic. You and your son walk all around Boston, the Boston you grew up in, until the age of 18 when you left for Hollywood.
Out of South Station.
So we have a clip of the documentary right here, and it's when you're in your, 16 or 17, when you're working for a rather disreputable vacuum company right on Boylston Street in 1948. Here's a listen.
They ran what they call a bait and switch operation. They would advertise a used Electrolux vacuum cleaner, which was a famous name, for $9 or $10. And the job was to sell upward. You got one for a sample to show. Don't sell it. The machine you want to sell cost about $100. So it took a certain amount of confidence and salesmanship. It was useful later in going on some of the acting auditions that I went on.
This was such a sweet documentary, you walking around with your son, until we realized that you were, you know, you're a shifty salesman.
Very shifty.
I was dangerous.
Very shifty.
But prior to that, I have to tell you, I was so moved because you grew up in the West End. And for people who don't know what the West End is, it's like the Lower East Side of New York. It's where
That's right.
immigrants went and you were all crowded, as I know you were, in apartment buildings. And that, and it was right adjacent to Mass General Hospital in the Charles River, prime location. And because of that reason, it was leveled, taken by eminent domain. So I'm wondering, what is it like that the fact that you essentially can't go home now, that you have all these wonderful memories of where you grew up, but it doesn't exist anymore?
It's very sad. Many years ago, maybe 25 years ago, I took my came to Boston with my wife, and I wanted to show her where I had grown up, and we could not find the street. We walked into the area that was the West End, but the streets are so totally reconfigured that there's no connection to what it used to be. The only connection we found that my son Adam and I found when we were making the documentary was the St. Joseph's Church. And we actually sat on the steps, he and I, of the St. Joseph's Church, and I pointed to the left where I could show him, where I could actually, where we could see St. Joseph's from the window of our apartment building. It was only half a block away. But now it was so totally different that it was unrecognizable. So in a sense, I feel uprooted, but at the same time, I still have a great connection with the city. I love being in Boston. I always look forward to coming back.
You know, Leonard Nimoy, I wonder how your parents reacted to taking of their neighborhood. Your father was a barber in Mattapan. Your mother was a homemaker. How did they react?
Well, they were very stubborn about leaving. They were they were among the last people to leave. They stayed and stayed and stayed. I left in 1949. And they were there until the very end. I think that building was one of the last to come down. They left, I think, in 1959. And by that time, the West End was just gone. And they would have stayed forever until they passed away. But they were just forced to move. They had to get out. Well, the building would have been torn down around them, so they moved out to Dorchester.
And did they keep in touch at all with the old neighbors from the West
End? Oh, yeah.
End?
Oh, yeah. The West End was a very close-knit neighborhood. It was really a village, in a way. There was a Harvard sociologist named Gans who wrote a book called The Urban Villagers about the West End. It was a unique neighborhood, absolutely unique.
So where did the young teen Leonard Nimoy hang out when he was a young ruffian around Boston?
I split my time between the Elizabeth Peabody House, which was on Charles Street, and the West End House, which was on Blossom Street. The Peabody House was a wonderful place that had a sports program, a science program. They had a science lab where my brother began his interest in science, and he became a chemical engineer with a graduate degree from MIT. And they also had a wonderful theater, a 375-seat theater, beautiful theater. And that's where I first started acting when I was 8 years old. I walked out on stage as Hansel in a production of Hansel and Gretel. And somehow I just kept on doing it. And by the time I was about 17... there was a play being done there called Awake and Sing, and I was cast in that as the juvenile. It was my first time in an adult drama, which was a family very much like my own family, three generations living in one apartment just like we did, my grandparents and my parents and my brother and I. And I was so taken with it. I was so moved by being involved in a play that really spoke to our generation about our people that I decided this was the way I wanted to make my life, my living, and this is the way I wanted to live my life. And that's when I decided to move to California and study acting seriously.
Well, it's so hard to believe that with this voice that you have, and of course we know it so well, as we mentioned at the Museum of Science, that you had a very thick Boston accent.
I did. I went to school at the Pasadena Playhouse School of the Theater. I was only there for about 6 months. I was disappointed in the school in general, but I had a great speech teacher. And when I left Boston, if you had asked me what part I played in the TV show, I would say I was Spock from Star Trek.
So it still comes right back to you. You can never escape it.
After about 6 months of hard work, it was really hard work. The change of speech is not easy. And because there's more to it than just the sound. There's a whole psychological thing about the way you sound. And I really didn't want to let it go. I thought, this is who I am, you know. But then I thought, I'd better change my speech because it'll make it possible for me to get more different kinds of work.
We're talking with Leonard Nimoy, who is in town by way of the Boston Pops, and also because this documentary that he made with his son premiered last night on WGBH Channel 2. You know, everyone knows you as Spock from Star Trek, but when I look at your resume, you were in almost every single solitary great television show from the late 50s and early 60s, Sea Hunt, The Twilight Zone, Highway Patrol with Broderick Crawford.
Right.
Yeah, Perry Mason, Rawhide. That was with Clint Eastwood, wasn't
Clint Eastwood, that's
right. Yeah, The Untouchables. That was another great series. You got any good stories from any of those? Got any tales from the young Clint Eastwood Perry Mason or anything?
Those were struggling days. I was happy to get each and every one of those jobs. I lived in a neighborhood a few blocks away from Lloyd Bridges, who was the star of this Sea Hunt television series.
I remember it.
And when things got really desperate, I would get in my car and drive by his house very slowly to see if maybe he was outside watering the lawn. And one time it actually worked. I was driving by. I'd worked the show a couple of times. I needed a job, and I was driving by, and there he was outside. And I yelled, "Hey, Lloyd, how are you? Leonard Nimoy, remember?" "Oh, yeah, yeah, what are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm looking for a job." He said, "Just a minute." He went inside the house, made a phone call, came back out, and he said, "You start in 2 days." I had a 3-day job, which paid a couple $100 and paid the rent that month.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, he was a great guy.
You were also on Bonanza.
Yes, a couple times.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, that's right. And Gunsmoke a couple times. And, I was on all those shows. I did them all. I did Rawhide. I did Wagon Train. I did, I played
the man
cops
from Uncle,
and robbers,
the man
and
Uncle.
I played good guys, bad guys. I played Indians. And every once in a while, I even did some science fiction. You know?
So, of course, you landed in this show that a lot of people have heard about. So I have a confession to make to you. A few years ago, I was in Greece. I was standing at the Plaka at the base of the Acropolis, and I heard this very distinctive voice behind
me.
Were
you there?
I was there. And I turned around because I think, that sounds like Leonard Nimoy. I spun around, and I saw this tall, distinguished gentleman. And what did I do to figure out if it was really you? I looked at your ears. I was such a warren. But I feel somewhat validated because I've come to understand that you brought a lot of yourself to Spock.
I did. I was very fortunate to find a role that welcomed me, and I welcomed it. I took it to heart. I was very serious about that character because I did. I identified with him a lot. Spock was a character who was sort of outside the mainstream. He was the other, the alien, and I grew up feeling that way. I felt that I was one of the minority. And Spock was not at home on Vulcan because he was half human. He was not at home on Earth because he was half Vulcan. The kids on Vulcan teased him because he was a half breed, and that's why he went into the space work. I was struck by what the character had in the way of intelligence, and usefulness, and professionalism, and dignity. Above all, dignity. It meant a lot to me. Yeah.
Why did the Leonard Nimoy, the real Leonard Nimoy, feel like you were an outsider? Why?
Well, I grew up in this very mixed neighborhood. The people on the floor below us were Italian. The people on the floor below that were Irish. We had very good friends in all of the denominations. But being Jewish, I was definitely in a minority.
You were in a minority.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So I felt like I was not mainstream, you know.
But that must be you, there must have been some comfort out in Los Angeles and Hollywood, because that's where a lot of people went when they're considered other, because they have these other artistic sensibilities, that they have
that's
these other selves. So did
well,
you find?
Well, it's true. I found a different kind of world in California where it was there was not that kind of strong cultural identity. It was an easier mix of people. Not that I enjoyed it more, but I felt I had a different feeling. I felt like, oh, okay, this is what California's all about. This is what Hollywood's all about. But the most important thing for me was to be involved in the arts. I wanted to make a living in the arts. And that's why I went to California, because I thought out there I had a chance to do it. And it worked out. It worked out for me, fortunately. It took a while. It took a while to build a career, but it worked out.
Leonard Nimoy, I read somewhere where you saved your last pair of ears.
I have them,
Where you got them? In the bathroom?
They're in a small box with a glass front sitting on my desk to remind me of where I came from.
Okay. And I also read, and I thought this was fascinating, and maybe it relates to what you just said about feeling a little bit like an outsider, that when you worked as on Star Trek, you'd be very long days during the week, get through on Friday, and then you somehow maintained your role as Spock on Saturday and well into Sunday afternoon. What was that about?
Yeah, well, I guess you'd call it method acting. I was deep inside this character for many hours each week, 12 hours a day for 5 days a week, 60 hours a week. I was in the spot character. I'd come home, take off the makeup, grab something fast to eat, study my lines for tomorrow, and still in Spock character, and go to sleep. Wake up in the morning and bang, right into the makeup chair and back into Spock. So the weekend was the only time that I had to slip out of the character, and it took a while. I could still feel Spock around all day Saturday, and he'd start to leave about midday on Sunday. And then I'd start to slip back into Leonard Nimoy. By Sunday night, I was free of Spock, but Monday morning, right back into character. For 3 years, that's the way it was.
So at the same time that you started your acting career in Hansel and Gretel, you also started a photography career. You were you're literally developing in your one bathroom that you're sharing with all of your family members.
Yes.
So you've had a lifelong passion for photography.
Yes, exactly. I mean, yes.
What's your entry point there? I mean, what really draws you by the still?
A neighborhood friend in the West End showed me how to develop a roll of film and make a print in your own darkroom. You could go to the Kodak store, which was on Bromfield Street, and for 15 cents you could buy a package of chemicals, and that was all you needed, and maybe a packet of paper for another 15 to 25 cents. So with that kind of an investment, I could take the family camera and go out and shoot some pictures and come home and start developing and making prints immediately in the bathroom, which was exciting to me, very exciting. I stayed with my interest in photography forever, but got serious about it when I finished Star Trek and did two seasons on Mission Impossible and left that show because I really had had enough of it. I went back to school to UCLA to study photography seriously because I really considered changing careers. What I realized was that I did not want to do commercial photography, shooting cars and clothes and fashion and that kind of. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do what's known as fine art photography. Very difficult to make a living at it, so I decided to stick with my acting career. But I've always loved photography, and I have continued to do it ever since.
We're speaking with Leonard Nimoy, who's done some very fascinating things with your career as a fine arts photographer. One of them was from a few years back, but I found this totally fascinating, was the Big Body Project, where you photographed a lot of women that are not just a little bit heavy, that are really, really heavy.
Large-bodied women. Yeah.
Yes, and they look, a lot of them, really beautiful, and you never see pictures like that. Why did you do that?
Well, it started with a woman who came to me after I was showing some of my earlier work from a project called Shekhinah in Northern California, where I had a home, and a woman came to me afterward, and she said, "I'm a model. I'm a different body type than you've been working with. Would you be interested in shooting me?" And she was a very large lady. And I was concerned. I thought, I'm not quite sure I know what to do with this, because I had been shooting classic type figures. She came to our studio, and my wife and I photographed her. And when I showed her pictures, she was quite large. When I showed her pictures along with other work, she was the one who got all the attention. People were fascinated because you never see that.
Exactly.
That kind of nude figure, almost like sculpture. And I thought there's something going on here in our culture that I think people are interested in and might want to learn about. So I found this group of women, large-bodied women in San Francisco, and I photographed them, and that became the full-body project.
What kind of reaction did you get? Because we never see or rarely see.
I got a lot of interest, a lot of people asking the same question. Who are these people, and why are you shooting them? And I was shooting them because there is this cultural question in our society about what people should look like. And women in our culture are told what they should look like by the cosmetic companies, the clothing companies, the diet companies. People want to sell you something.
That's right.
Take these pills. Buy these clothes, take this exercise program, buy it from us, and you will look like you're supposed to look, you know. Well, what are you supposed to? You're supposed to look like who you are. And people have been taught to chase this dream by paying something to somebody to try to achieve that kind of a look. So that's what it was all about. I thought it was very interesting to raise the conversation about this subject.
Did it change the way you made photography after? Because you just mentioned how you were sort of anxious about doing it and you didn't quite know how to do it. So it must have tested you. So did it?
You know, many years ago, I had a good friend named Marcia Tucker, who was the founder of the New Museum of Contemporary Art in New York. For a while, she was the chief curator at the Whitney Museum. She was a good friend and a great supporter of the arts. And she said to me, "Do what scares you as an artist. Do what scares you. Do the thing that you would normally shy away from and explore it. Let's find out what's there that scares you and bothers you. Maybe you'll find something interesting." And that's what I was thinking when I took on the full body project. I thought, this scares me. I'm going to do it.
Oh, go ahead, Joe.
I was going to ask if you shoot on film or digital.
I shot almost exclusively on film, which I processed myself until my last project, which was called Secret Selves, which I shot in Northampton.
Tell people about that. That was a fascinating one, too.
Yeah. Well, I came across this this story from the ancient Greeks. Supposedly, there was a symposium discussing human angst. What is this thing that we all feel uneasy about? And Aristophanes, a poet, a philosopher of the period, said that he had an explanation for human angst. He said, humans at one time were double people, attached back to back. We had four arms, four legs, and two heads.
Really?
And, yeah. And he said that the humans became very powerful and arrogant. And I don't know how you'd be powerful. And I think you'd be encumbered, you know. But he said, anyway, that's what he said. And he said the gods became angry. And they sent Zeus to solve the problem. So Zeus took a big sword, split everybody in two, and sent them on their separate paths, and we became two hands, two feet, and one head. However, he said, ever since then, humans have felt some part of themselves is missing. Something is missing in their lives. And that's the explanation of human angst, people trying to get in touch with their other part of themselves to reintegrate, to become whole again. I thought, what a fascinating story. So we set up a series of interviews and portrait sessions in Northampton where I photographed 100 people. They were invited to come and have me photograph them as their secret or hidden or fantasy self. And boy, some wonderful people came in with that.
And you had a big exhibit at BU as well of that, which was wildly well received. Leonard Nimoy, it has been fascinating and wonderful and a great treat to speak with you.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for being with us. We were speaking with actor Leonard Nimoy. He was in town earlier this year hosting the Boston Pops Out of This World space-themed production. Coming up, it's an interview with John Waters, the man who's given us Hairspray, Pink Flamingos, and an appreciation for bad taste. He now offers his own Hitchhiker's Guide Through America. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just joining us, we're replaying some of our favorite conversations from over the year. We pick things up with a man who is relying on the kindness of strangers to pick him up. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Our next guest likes the tilapia at Ruby Tuesdays. He has a penchant for Days Inn motels. And he's developed an unlikely friendship with a 20-year-old Republican councilman from Myersville, Maryland. We're talking about legendary John Waters. And what you just learned about him, John learned about himself when he hitchhiked across the country, thumbing his way from Baltimore to San Francisco. His road trip is the stuff of his great new book, Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. If you don't know John from his books, you obviously know him from his brilliant films, such as Hairspray and Pink Flamingos. He'll be at the Brattle Theater tomorrow night. We'll give you the details in a few minutes. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's great to talk to you, John Waters. But as Jim just said, I mean, you are, you know, a famous guy, Hairspray, Pink Flamingos. Some people that you were hitchhiking picked you up knew you. Some people didn't. So my question is, why, at this stage of your life, would you do this?
Because you need an adventure. No matter how old you are, you have to reinvent. You have to get some street cred. You have to take a chance. You can't do anything sitting in your house for the rest of your life.
Let me tell you something. I'd jump out of a plane, with a helicopter, with George H.W. Bush before I'd hitchhike across America, John Waters. Let me tell you.
You ought to try it. I tell you, it's a you meet new friends. It's better than a dating service. It gives you, you're in your own little reality show, short subjects every day when you get in a car with somebody. It's not so dangerous. I mean, it's dangerous to not take a chance.
But you're a Social Security eligible guy. I think you're fabulous.
Haven't gotten mine yet.
Okay, fine. Well, you're a fabulous looking guy, but I think you'd admit you're a tad scary looking too. Would you pick you up if you were driving on the road between Baltimore and San Francisco?
Maybe. If I had my son that said, I'm not psycho, I would have picked me up for that one. Others didn't. They laughed, but they didn't pick me up. Yeah, they couldn't really tell it was me because it was raining and I had a poncho on, or I had this hat that was really an unfortunate choice. It said Scum of the Earth. But I thought, that's the name of a great exploitation movie. So I thought, well, this will attract other film buffs. But and you really couldn't read that when you're going by 60 miles an hour. That was worse when I'd get in the car and they'd see it. But I tried to take that off sometimes. Would I pick me up? Maybe. It depends. I have picked up hitchhikers. I've told this before, but it's true. The last time I picked up a hitchhiker was 10 in the morning in Baltimore, and it was a younger guy, and he got in the car and started huffing glue. And I thought, well, make yourself comfortable. But he offered me some. I said, no, it was Tuesday morning. Maybe later in the evening I would have. But I thought, well, gee, make yourself comfortable. And he said, okay, you want some?
So tell us about your fame kit. I thought that was a very clever idea.
Well, I knew that, you know, beside carrying ID with me, if the policeman ever came over and really gave me trouble, no one has showed them a fame kit, which is a review of when your play won the Tony Award or when my Directors Guild of America card. I love showing that, or my Academy of Arts and Science. Like, excuse me, I vote for the Oscars. So I think that I have immunity in the state of Ohio to hitchhike. And I actually did. It worked because the cop gave me a ride.
Yeah, that's a great story. Tell us about the cop.
Well, he was very nice, and he said, well, it doesn't say you're a professional hitchhiker after you read the whole thing. And then I said, well, you could give me a ride then. He said, well, I will. Get in, which I loved. I was in the back in the cage. I felt so glamorous. You know? And then he said, I can only take you across the state line. And he was dishing kind of the state troopers who get all the credit when the local cops do all the work. And then he said, I'm going to come back and check on you later. And I got stuck there. I was there for hours. And he did come back. And then he said, shake your sign or something. He was giving me grief for not being aggressive enough at hitchhiking, which was really embarrassing to get a bad hitchhiking review from a cop.
We're talking to the brilliant filmmaker and writer, John Waters. His new book is called Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. You face some of the conundrums that those of us who are too scared to hitchhike worry about. You spend hours somewhere. Someone finally stops John Waters, who looks like a serial killer. What goes through your head as to whether or not you get in after all that endless waiting or you don't get in?
Well, it depends which serial killer.
Yeah. You said you would have gotten in with Ted Bundy.
Well, only because, you know, he was kind of cute, you know, but still, you believe me, everything you think you won't do, you will do once you've been standing there 10
You mean
years.
Out of desperation?
I would have gotten in Ted Bundy in a Volkswagen when if he had his arm in a sling. I said, oh, we all have bad nights. Let me in. You know, you really change what you think you'll do when you're hitchhiking.
So wait,
just one more thing, though, that actually the thing that I think about all the time about hitchhiking is the bathroom issue.
Oh, and, elimination problem.
Elimination. And do you ask? And if you do ask, do you take your stuff with you, which insults the person?
Oh, I always do because I'm a thief. I used to be a thief when I'm young, so I have bad karma. So, oh, yeah, I would always make up some excuse saying, I need to get this in here. I have some toiletries in here or something.
Yeah.
I just was afraid they'd pull off when I was in the bathroom with my suitcase.
And
I didn't eat much because... you can't be saying a pullover again. You have to pee again. Well, Christ, I'm on. You know, so I really ate very little and did not drink a lot of coffee or tea in the morning for that very fact. And then in the part of the book where I imagine the worst, I get diarrhea, which is the very worst thing that could happen to you if you were hitchhiking. I mean, think about it.
Well, speaking of the worst, you have a rather graphic chapter in there about when you get picked up by a guy who hated people who made films like yours. Tell us what happened.
Oh, that's
there.
How I get murdered by a person. Because everybody said before, well, there's serial killers that kill hitchhikers. And I say, I'll be honest, though. Their type is not usually 66-year-old male film directors. Unfortunately, they kill young women, usually. So I thought up a killer that hated all cult movies and takes me to this torture dungeon where other cult directors have either been murdered or tied up. And I don't want to really tell you how I died, but I did write my death the day, 2 days before I left and hitchhiked for real.
Yeah. And we should be clear, the book is divided into three things. It's sort of the best that could happen, the worst
with
that could happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, in the imagination of John Waters. And then what really did happen.
I was
and of
upset.
Course, if you're imagining the worst, it's you get killed. I mean, that is the worst that can happen.
I know, and especially when you went by the babies in Limbo. I thought they'd eliminated the babies in Limbo, but that was a very distressing little fact. So you did. As Jim said, you had the stuff that the good stuff that happened and the bad stuff that happened. You just told us some of the bad stuff that happened. Tell us one of the chapters about the good stuff, the best stuff.
In the fictitious
portion.
In the fictitious part, yeah. The first, Rod picks up and gives me $5 million to make my movie and digs up their pot dealers. And they dig up, and they own a corrupt FedEx office nearby. And they mail it to me. And they say, oh, we don't give notes. We don't care if we get the money back. Here's $5 million. Then I get picked up by a librarian who's an insane alternative librarian that delivers books to the obscure collectors that only want pre-porn paperbacks by famous artists that did the cover, but the covers are ripped off. They collect them. So it was an insane librarian. I get picked up by a driver that wants to have sex in the car, which I do, in the middle of the race, and we win.
Doesn't get much better than that.
When I go home with him later, he wants to show porn, but his porn is pictures of demolition derbies where they refuse to go backwards and go forwards and smash into cars.
We are talking with John Waters, the famous filmmaker who's just written a fantastic book called Carsick about his adventures hitchhiking across the country. So you obviously had a real adventure being hitchhiking across the country, and you were picked up by a guy you referred to as the guy in the Corvette. Tell us about him.
The Corvette Kid. He was going to have lunch at the subway in the pouring rain in Millersville, Maryland, and saw me, didn't know who I was, never heard of me, never heard of my films, and picked me up, and I just kept talking, and he took me to Ohio with his parents, rather concerned where he was. And then he came back, and he said, well, I'll come get you later, and I thought he was kidding, and I got stuck, and I was in Ohio. I got stuck in Kansas. It takes a long time. So finally, he tweeted me and said, what do you mean you got to ride through Kansas? I've been driving 48 hours at 80 miles an hour. I almost caught up with you. And he eventually does in Denver and gives me another ride. So we had a little bromance. It was totally innocent. He was a straight 20-year-old Republican, and I'm, a filth elder. But we got along great. It was fun. We were the odd couple.
And how did he – at what stage of this thing, John Waters, did he realize who you were, and how did he find out who you were, and how did he confirm who you were?
Well, I told him, but he didn't really know. He had never heard of any of the movies or anything. So I think when we stopped, he Googled me and saw it was real. But his parents were freaking because if you Google me, it's not very comforting to a father and mother. But your son has run off with this person. I just won some big gay award. I fought for parole of one of the Manson family. I made a film, the Variety called the most disgusting film in film history. So it's not what a parent really likes to read about when their son is missing in another state in their car when he went to lunch at the subway. And I kept offering to talk to them. I understood why they were upset, but he wouldn't let me.
Well, John Waters, you talked about how this young man is
the Corvette Kid,
yeah. Republican running for office. How did his association with you play out in the campaign? Did you ever find out?
Well, let's say this. He had already won. When he picked me up, he was in office. He was the youngest elected official. And somebody in the press just told me now they found out he is no longer a councilman. So I think that was his choice. I don't think he ran for office and they showed pictures of me against him. You know what I mean? Like door to door. This is a guy that picked up John Waters and ran away with him. Don't vote for him. I think he would have won because who wouldn't take an adventure? Who wouldn't take a free trip? Who wouldn't be that curious?
Is he the one? I can't remember. I think maybe confusing your drivers or whatever the proper nomenclature. Is he the one you gave the keys to your place in San Francisco to and hung out there?
We just kept going, and then I said, I need a couple more rides, so the books are here. Here's my keys. Go to and stay in my house in San Francisco, which he did. That really alarmed his parents.
you also had people that the story about the 81-year-old farmer who just kind of thought you were down on your luck.
I love that,
I found
actually.
That a very kind of touching little story.
Yeah, and he tried to give me money, and I at first didn't even know what he was doing. I was so stunned by it. But his kindness was amazing, and a lot of people just thought I was a homeless person. People pulled over to try to give me money. One woman wouldn't leave until I took the money, and then I passed it along to another weary traveler on the road.
How did this change your worldview, both large and small? I mean, your sense of your fellow human being, as well as parts of the country. I mean, you have a Baltimore place, you have a San Francisco case, you're sort of a coast this kind of guy, like a lot of us are. How did it change your feeling about the middle of this country?
Well, I spent my whole life fleeing the middle. I get along in prison, I get along in Paris, but I have trouble in a shopping mall. So basically, this gave me, I think, the middle has radically changed. I think the middle is so much more open, so much more willing to listen to new things than it was, that it was very optimistic. Now, I'm only dealing with people that pick up hitchhikers.
That's a good point.
And people that pick up hitchhikers usually have survived something. They usually believe in people. They have a sense of humor about themselves. And they're skeptical but willing to change their mind.
You know, John Waters, you had a wonderful description of some of these breakfast rooms in these different motels that you would stay in along the way. Tell us a little bit about those.
They're very grim. The food, no wonder people get in car accidents. I mean, you know, these were like eggs that look like pop art, like Oldenburg's eggs. And bread, I never knew they made bread this white. There wasn't a vitamin left in this bread. Like, communion was like wheat bread compared to this. It was just, I don't know. And everybody just grimly standing, watching the TV, making no eye contact. And the lighting, like the emergency room, where in your hotel, the room, it's so dark, no one's ever read a magazine. They didn't even have newspapers anywhere in the middle of the country. Not even USA Today. Nothing. Do you have the local town paper here? They looked at you like you were insane when you asked for that.
Hey, John, can we step back from the book for a second? Because I've actually, you know, I'm a Philly boy, and I hear the Baltimore in your accent a little. Divine, obviously, is the person who many of us most associate you with, you know, from obviously Mondo, right. Trasho, Pink Flamingos. I didn't realize till a couple of weeks ago, you knew each other as teens. Did you grow up together? What's your Divine connection pre-film?
Well, we didn't know each other. We met when we were 17. Okay. His parents moved to my parents' neighborhood a couple houses away, and his family ran a nursery school for children, and he was the only child, which was an odd advertisement.
Yeah.
And so essentially, and you became friends? What was the relationship like?
Yeah, and I was making moves. Divine was like a overweight nerd that got beat up in school every day. But that anger and that rage that he had from high school, he used really in the character of Divine later that we collaborated on and thought up together. So I think he was very different. Divine never walked around dressed as a woman ever, except
really?
When he was working. No, he had no desire to be a woman. He was an actor, and he liked playing men, too. And right before he died, he was supposedly going to play... He was definitely going to play the gay uncle in Married with Children, which would have been one of the first gay characters ever on a TV sitcom that probably would have been very successful.
And he died in his 40s, did he not?
Yeah, 42 years old. Yeah.
One other person that obviously was not a star in your films that I've always been weirded out by is Patty Hearst has been in more than one of... in sort of cameos in John Waters...
she's had more than cameos. She's certainly a member of my acting troupe.
And what's that like?
Comedian.
What's she like? How did that happen?
Well, I certainly went to the trial. I didn't know her. I was obsessed by her case. And later she said, yeah, it's people like you. I went to prison. I just sat next to her at the Cannes Film Festival when the Paul Schrader movie Patty was playing, which was sort of based on her side of the story. And I just liked it, and we became friends. And I said, you should come be in one of my movies. And she thought I was kidding. So when we made Cry Baby, we called her, and she came and auditioned. And we worked with her. And I think she's a good comedian. Who wants to be a famous victim? She was so weary of that basically if she never signed an autograph ever till she made a movie. And then she had fun with us. She was good in the movies. I wouldn't have put her in if I didn't think she was good. And she even played a mother of a kidnapped victim in Pecker. I mean, you know, she really mocked the whole thing because you can't change it. She's sick of talking about it. You know, who wants to be a famous victim? Nobody.
That's a great point.
And she was always telling the truth. I mean, that's why she's alive. They thought she was in that building when they burned it down with everybody, all the rest of the SLA in it. So they would have killed her. She is right to what she did.
We're talking to John Waters, who, in addition to his brilliant films, is an author. His latest work is Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America, and he did.
So I want one last thing about the hitchhiking. Was there anybody that you just looked at and said, no, I'm not getting in this car?
No, but somebody did that to me. They pulled over and I ran up and they said, oh, never mind, when they saw me.
Okay.
I thought, well, I'm looking ugly today. Damn. I better get that moisturizer on tonight.
Yeah, so you did mention how it's tough on your face and yourself to be out there.
That wind whipping in Kansas, let me tell you, Dorothy was right.
So what's next?
What do you?
Yeah. What's next? I mean, you did this. You did this in your 60s. Now, do you have some big project planned for the next decade, John? Or
I've got a lot of projects planned, but they're usually in development. I have a TV show. I'm trying to do a movie, but I never talk about it until it's real. The next thing, actually, this book comes out in Europe. I'm going there. I have a Christmas show I do all over the world. I have 20 dates in December. I'm going to write another book. Yeah, I'm a writer. That's what I did. I wrote all my movies. It just depends which form of writing I do.
Why don't you just segue to Brazil for the World Cup or something, John?
I've been to Brazil. I like it there. It's scary. It really is. It's because too many Catholics run that country. I'll tell you, that's why it's out of control, because they don't have birth control or abortion.
Hey, John, before we let you go, we talk a lot on this show about the renaissance, for lack of a better expression, of great television, whether it's True Detective or Fargo or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Have you been... you of all people, it seems to me, would be somebody that people would be running after nonstop to do one of these 8-part, 10-part weird and wonderful things. Are you in the mix in any of those things?
I haven't really been. I do agree with you that even though I don't watch it, and I'm not bragging because I still like to read every night, but the TV is better than films now. It's way better. And there's great shows on and everything. And yes, I have been recently talking about a TV show. We'll see if it happens. I certainly would do it. It's not being snobby about it in any way. But actually, so many more people see it, and you have so much more freedom to do it. So yes, I think TV's the best it's ever been.
9 episodes, 9 days, John Waters hitchhikes across America. What do you think, John?
Well, it could certainly work, because I would be the real me hitchhiking, and while I'm waiting for cars, I imagine the best and the worst.
Hey, John Waters, we're thrilled to have talked to you.
We were speaking with John Waters about his new book, Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. Before we close today's show, we're going to play an excerpt of an interview we did with an escape artist last year. Earlier in the show, Teller of the Penn and Teller Illusionist duo talked about his admiration for Houdini. It reminded us that we had interviewed a modern-day Houdini of sorts, escape artist Alexandria the Great. We begin the conversation with her explaining the escape act that landed her national fame when she was on America's Got Talent.
The act that I just... completed was actually one of a kind. It's the first time it was ever done, ever. I have an underwater cell, which we call UC, because you can see everything. And what I did was I took two of Houdini's greatest escapes, his straitjacket escape and his water, his milk can escape. And so I was in my water cell. I had 25 feet of chain, 5 padlocks, on top of a regulation straitjacket. I went underwater. I had to hold my breath, and they locked the lid. So I had to get out of the chains, the straitjacket, and then pick the lock on the outside of the lid.
Oh my God.
And get out. And
I don't want to be disrespectful. I did that this weekend.
You did. You did.
I mean,
how did you do it?
It's not that big a deal.
Oh, wait a minute. Okay. So how long did it take you to do that?
Well, the unfortunate thing with America's Got Talent, if you know anything, they give you 90 seconds.
Yeah.
So that's kind of for everything. So I did it in 1:10. So
wow. So you beat the clock.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah.
Now you just before we get back to America's Got Talent, you've got children, right? You've got 2 daughters. Bill's over here. You're the husband. I mean, I used to watch, as I told you, Tony Curtis and Houdini when I was a little girl. I had a heart attack just watching him on television. Something could happen to the mother of your children over here, Bill.
You know, we obviously do everything we can from a training perspective to keep her as safe as possible. You know, we like to say she doesn't have a death wish, she has a life wish. But, you know, we think that there's a lot of symbolism in what she does. And in terms of getting out of your box. And that's what literally she did the other night. And for her to kind of do this, you know, we obviously made sure that we had the best training in the world. David Blaine did an underwater escape. We went to the same free diving group, performance free diving, to be able to get her ready for this. So before I allow any of this stuff to happen, because you know what? That's the love of my life. She's my junior prom date. We've been doing this since we were kids.
Yeah.
Yep. Before we leave you, though, I'm watching you during, I don't know, one of your performances. I'm not sure which it was, your wife's performances. You're smiling. You're looking totally relaxed through maybe the first 50 seconds. I may be off a little.
Yeah, okay.
But you're, it appears, I wouldn't say your anxiety level, your concern level is growing as the clock is moving. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what are you thinking at that particular time?
You know, we train and we practice. I can read her like a book. So we've got this kind of nonverbal communication that we can do. And I feel comfortable at about 45 seconds, 50 seconds. After that, I know it's touch and go. And that's where, you know, I'm rooting for her. You heard a cackle in the back. That was me. I was just so excited that she got out. And, you know, every time she gets out, I feel like I got out. You know, it's like, oh, my God, thank God she's out.
You know, you're sort of Grandma Moses-esque from what I read. I mean, not no, I mean,
about?
In terms of your talent. How old were you?
Yeah, she's
how old were you when you started? I mean, I know you did this when a kid, but when you started doing it professionally, you were not a kid anymore. How old
no,
were you?
No, actually, I started my very first escape, miraculously was called The Underwater Leap of Faith, which truly it was for me, was 2009. So I was 47 when I did this.
47. So you start.
But you did this as a little girl and kept it a secret.
Right. So, I hid it. I was in my box.
So what does this mean? You were in the pool in the backyard or at the lake in the pond climbing a lot of things when you were a little girl?
Well, I had a pool growing up. And, you know, when Bill and I met, I always had a love for magic. But when we were growing up in the 70s, you know, we had Doug Henning and David Blaine and they would – I mean, excuse me, David Copperfield. And they would do all these shows and that's what I would see. So I would see them – you know, they would start with the cups and balls and linking rings and then they would go on to an illusion. And then they would end with a beautiful Houdini-like escape. And very challenging, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to start there.
You know, by the way, as I'm looking to Alexandria the Great, Alex Purnell, as she's talking to Marjorie, what's the necklace you're wearing there, Alex? Could you describe that
well,
to the listeners?
This is my lock that my husband gave me when I very first went on stage in 2009. So it's kind of like my lucky charm.
So how old are your kids?
I actually have three.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. I have a 22-year-old daughter. I have a 19-year-old daughter. And I have a 15-year-old son. And my 22-year-old daughter has a 9-month-old baby boy.
Congratulations, Grandma.
Congratulations.
So I was right when I said Grandma Moses. Right. Okay, yeah. So when your teenagers call you on the phone after they hear this and say, or if they haven't already, hey, Mom, I'm thinking of becoming an escape artist when I grow up. We'll ask your husband and say, what do you say to them?
Well, you know, I'd probably say, are you sure? And let's arm you with the right tools. You know, we at our house, my son's a goalie, so we always talk about, you know, tools in your toolbox. And
you get
you know,
scared when you're, I have to
yeah,
say,
that's what I
I'm
know.
Watching this and I am, I'm hyperventilating.
Scared. So tell us what it's like to be under the water in the straitjacket with all the locks and padlocks.
The thing that people don't understand, because they see the whole thing and then they see it, me get out, but everything has an element of uncertainty. So the chains, I mean, we can practice all we want, but sometimes every single time we do it, the chaining is different. I've had times when I've been practicing this and because there's buckles in the back of the straitjacket that the chains have literally gotten caught on the back of the straitjacket.
And then what happens? Does someone come rescue you? What happens?
No, that's when I use my mind over matter, and if it doesn't mind to me, I do whatever I have to get out. And so it's perseverance. It's a challenge. And at the end of the day, I know I have three kids that I need to get home for, and I will do any means necessary to get out.
Well, how long can someone live without breathing? About 2 minutes?
You know, well, Bill seems to know. What's the answer, Bill?
With freediving, I mean, and that's why we really wanted to arm her with something, something real. Some freedivers, the women's record for a breath hold is 8 minutes.
8 minutes,
it's amazing what you can do. But, that said, that's a static breath hold. That's the old dead man's float where you don't move.
When you're not trying to rescue yourself from a straitjacket and chains.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, panic is it will take your breath away just like that.
Okay.
And so anything happens wrong, you really have to have the mental fortitude to be able to kind of push through. She trains. We train worse case scenario, and so that, you know, she deals with contractions. She can do up to 52 contractions, and that's your body saying, hey, you need to breathe and she can ignore that.
What are contractions? You mean like breathing?
Yeah,
like
if you start to run out of air,
oh, okay,
your body will kind of start to kickstart it and go like that.
So, we're talking to Alex Purnell, Alexandria the Great, who just did this remarkable thing on America's Got Talent and does it in lots of places, and her husband,
yes,
Bill.
And Howard Stern loved you.
Well, let's hear Mandel and Howard Stern. I've never heard Howard Stern say anything good about anybody except a naked woman. Here are the Howards.
This was like the best escape artist that I have seen.
Oh, thank you.
I think Houdini has been reincarnated.
Thank you.
He said he was going to come back.
Well, you know.
Harry, is that you? Anyway, Howard, what'd you think?
Home run, A+. This is a tough thing to pull off, and you pulled it off.
You had to think that there's no way Howard Stern's going to say anything good at all about a middle-aged woman. Is that not a – no matter what you did, right?
That was always in the back of my mind. To be honest, you know, I thought about doing this last season, and then we heard Howard was going to be the judge, and I'm not a size 2. That was a box that I had myself in. And I just didn't think that he would – understand what I was doing. And
he was effusive. He was so into it. It was unbelievable.
Oh, my God. He's been my biggest supporter in this whole thing. And, you know, I mean, I love him. Love him for it.
So, Alex, let's get back to this, being underwater and something goes wrong. Now, mm-hmm. if something goes wrong, do you, Bill, say, okay, after 2 minutes, we got to pull her up? Or what's – I mean, because you're not going to let your wife die down there.
So do you want to know a secret, if everybody can kind of keep a secret out there?
Sure.
Okay. So Alex's secret is when she's in trouble – yeah, and
what do you do?
I stick out my tongue.
Really?
Well, because it's the only part on me that isn't flailing.
Oh, okay.
So he knows that if I stick out my tongue, if I look at him and I stick out my tongue, then yeah, something's wrong.
Has that happened?
Yes.
And what was the circumstance?
Probably the underwater cell is probably the beginning of that. It's probably the best story you can tell.
Okay. When we first, Franklin Glass built me this underwater cell. It's made of Lexan, so it's bulletproof, shatterproof, cannot break it to get out. So when we first got it, we decided to do a dry run. Well, the dry run meant that we were going to fill it with water, I was going to go in, and then I was going to get out. And neither Bill and I are science majors. So we didn't realize we had the lid open and we filled it. Well, we didn't realize that you need to have the lid on and, you know, the way you want it in the end when you're filling it up. So we had filled it up and everything else. And so then when I went in, held my breath, Bill put the lid down, and he had to kind of pull the lid a little bit in order to – it had shifted to put it – to lock it. And so he had difficulty doing that, which we figured no big deal. Well, then I gave him the sign, the thumbs up, like, okay, I need to get out. He couldn't open the lid. So
it was the worst feeling in the world. And what it was we didn't realize she had a wetsuit on when she was doing it, and she was pushing up against it, and we had the lock in the front of it, so it was bound, and I didn't know that. We were in our garage. I had to run from my garage into the house to try to get a snorkel because I couldn't figure out how to open it up. She had to be under at least 3.5, maybe 4 minutes, and she hung on. So that free diving, which a lot of people say is dangerous or looks dangerous, you know, it saved her life.
Oh my God!
That was probably the worst.
So how do you concoct these terribly creative things, escapes, performances? Where do they come from? Your head, the two of your heads? Well, I'm serious. How do you do this?
We do it as a combination. I do like to pay homage to Houdini because he is my idol. But the one thing, if you know anything about Houdini, is he didn't like people that copied him. And I do believe that if he was here today, he wouldn't be doing what he did, you know, 80 mm-hmm. years ago. So what we do is we do research. We look and we see what's out there and how can we give it the Alexandria the Great twist. You know,
so I mean, obviously, you just did this on America's the Talent Show, but where else do you do this? Are there places people can go see you perform this?
I would love. That was what I was hoping to do, is to get exposure so I could do this. I think what I do is truly something that can transcend to any type of venue. I'd love to do corporate gigs. I would love to talk to children. I'm working with Girls Inc. to do inspirational talks for them.
Are you in a rush now? We could fill the studio with water and we can just see.
I don't think I'd fill the studio because I believe there's some electrical things here.
That's right. Yeah.
So is there a website where people can find you guys? What is it?
It's alexandriathegreat.com. And it has...
And the spelling of it is Alexander. This is my fault on this. The spelling is Alexander IA.
Okay.
Because so, a lot of people have kind of missed that a little bit. So I've had to do a little tweaking to be able to make sure people get to the website. But it's Alexander IA, the great duck.
Now, Bill, you're sort of, you're the teammate, manager, whatever. One of the things I was thinking about, I'm saying, so if your wife decides, when I'm reading all this stuff and watching this morning, she doesn't want to do this anymore, I'm sure you thought, she can just pick locks for a living. Jerry, I'm serious. I mean, the potential. So what's next for you, Alexandria the Great?
Well, we're hoping to get some sponsors so that we can go on to some bigger and better things. I would like to work on a different variation of Houdini's Water Torture Cell.
We were speaking with escape artist Alexandria the Great. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Our production crew includes producers Chelsea Murs, Will Roslip, Amanda McGowan, our terrific intern Devin Karambolis, and our show's engineers John Parker and Alan Mattis. We're a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio.